Blog Talk Radio.
Hello there, this is Cliff, your host for Earth Ancients. Welcome. It's Saturday, the 12th of July, and I am broadcasting from Oakland today. And this has been a fascinating week, some fascinating, amazing new discoveries in the Middle East. We got a report from Graham Hancock, who was actually in Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, on some new ruins that he had discovered, which are close to Göbekli Tepe. But the thing that I was amazed at was his trip to Baalbek, Lebanon, where he was viewing the quarry just outside of the main temple, the complex there in Baalbek. And when he was actually standing on this one quarried stone that just about ready to be excised from the ground, apparently there was, at the same time he was there, there was a research team from France and Turkey that had discovered another megalith, huge stone that was buried in about 3 to 4 feet of dirt. And I posted a photograph, one of the photographs of this stone, and it is in excess of 1,100 tons. Of course, conventional archaeologists, anthropologists want us to believe that this stone was easily cut, easily excised, easily moved into place using manpower. Well, I personally don't know how they did it. I'm not about to claim there was another technology involved, but it really does appear that it's a feat of unknown quantity and quality involved. I say this because it's been reported a number of times. We can go all the way back to Zachariah Sitchin's book, 12th Planet, where he describes these megaliths, these 1,000-ton megaliths, and the precision cutting, almost like a diamond saw was used, or some kind of plasma laser or something was used to cut these stones in a precision, a level of precision that we can barely duplicate today. So take a look at this. I call it the new megalith discovered at Baalbek Stone Quarry in Lebanon. It's on the Facebook page, and I have a number of photographs there. Actually, I even have I took a satellite shot of the quarry, and I show the two standing stones, and then the new stone, the one they just discovered a week ago, is on display, and it's quite a sight. Now, on Graham Hancock's page, which I'm going to share later today, he and his wife actually took photographs of the excavated new stone and how deep they're not quite even finished on the depth of this stone. So it could actually exceed the 1,100 ton weight, and they're not even halfway done in terms of digging out this stone. So it's quite amazing. So do have a look. The other thing, the other area is that I want to mention is the Yoganani Island in the Pacific Ocean off of the Japanese coast. They recently have uncovered a number of what appear to be, and I called it, it's Yoganani Island. The megaliths on the surface of the planet duplicate or are very reminiscent of the monolith that is under the water that everyone's talked about. I didn't realize that there are man-made stoneworks on the surface. Now, no one's really talked about that, and I don't know of any books that have been written about it, but the one thing that's quite unique is the stonework is cut in a certain way that is very advanced. And again, I haven't been there, but I've found a number of photographs of the surface of the island that reveal man-made buildings. In fact, there's one photograph where a Japanese researcher actually claims it's the remnants of a face, a huge stone face. And I don't know, it's you got to look at it. Maybe thousands and thousands of years ago, before there was an earthquake or something like that, it actually was a face. And the one photograph that I do post, the one that I was sent, does appear to be a face of somebody, but it's a partial face, if it was a face at all. I'm not really sure. You'll have to take a look at it. But, of course, this is the unique aspect of it. Robert Schock has speculated that the ruins and the sculpture itself, the monolith that's underwater, is between 23,000 and 19,000 B.C., which makes it exceedingly old. So do have a look at that. That's something you consider. Now, you know, what were the technologies of these ancient people? We don't really know. Authors and engineer like Chris Dunn, who wrote a fantastic book called The Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, speculates that there was a technology in place that these people used in Egypt, but also he's commented on Central and South American stonework and the technology that may have been used in the creation of those pyramids and of the massive megaliths that are in Cusco and Sacsayhuaman, which is a place that I'm fascinated with in Peru. So how did they quarry these things? What were the methods of extraction? What was the science? We just don't know. But my guest today has looked at it from the perspective of our government looking into these questions. So we need to see, you know, maybe our government has looked and actually done research. You know, we have the biblical stories of the miracles, which, you know, from a modern perspective could be technology at work. So today's guest is great author. He's written a tremendous number of books. His name is Nick Redfern. And today's book that we're going to focus on is The Pyramids and the Pentagon, The Government's Top Secret Pursuit of Mystical Relics, Ancient Astronauts, and Lost Civilizations. Now, like I said, Nick has written a number of books. He's an author of 20 books, including The NASA Conspiracies, The Real Men in Black, and Contactees. He's appeared on numerous TV shows, including The History Channel, Ancient Aliens, Monster Quest, UFO Hunters, and also BBC's Out of This World. So, Nick, can you hear me? Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Cliff.
Great. So tell me what the motivation was in writing this book on the government's interest in these ancient questions.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess like any author, when you write a book, one of the main things I always think about is that if people are going to go out and buy your book, you want to be able to give them something new, you know, bring something new to the table, not just go over old ground. Now, of course, over the years, or the decades, I should say, there have been dozens, probably hundreds of books written on ancient mysteries, the whole ancient astronauts angle. And it's one I've been sort of fascinated by since I was a kid. And always thought about, well, you know, how about if I wrote a book on it, but the important thing was not to go over old ground, not just repeat what we'd seen before. And it was, so the challenge was coming up with an angle that hadn't really been touched on. And one of the things I found, one of the things I do, I should say, is I often use the Freedom of Information Act to obtain files, sort of declassified files going back 20, 30, 40, 50 years from various government agencies. And when I was digging through some of the files at the National Archives and other official archives, I occasionally came across references to what appeared to be official interest in ancient mysteries. And a lot of these are just snippets of stories. So I thought, well, why don't I sort of dig into these deeper, file some more requests, and see what actually surfaces. And so this was like a two-year process of research, which ultimately led to the release of hundreds of pages of documents showing official interest in everything from the pyramids, Noah's Ark, Stonehenge, all sorts of things. And so in many respects, although it kind of sounds a bit predictable, it is not unlike the whole scenario in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you have secret individuals or clandestine bodies taking an interest in the mysteries of the past, and in many respects trying to figure out if this technology existed, or advanced technology existed, and if it did, could it actually be weaponized? It's clear from the documents that that was one of the major areas that was focused upon.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's funny, your book is packed filled with references and stories that you've uncovered, but I want to touch on just a few, because there's just so much that our listeners can get into. Let's talk about the reference point that you just started with, which is the secret of the Ark in that chapter. You describe a flyover in 1947 on Mount Ararat looking for evidence of the Ark, but they also found something else. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, sure.
I think they found a ship. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the story of Noah's Ark in itself, you know, is a controversial one. To find that there are government files, when I say governments, that's sort of a collective term for the US Air Force, the CIA, and the Pentagon. They have all had, to varying degrees, interest in the story of Noah's Ark. Now, as far as the official interest goes, it all goes back to 1949, and a US Air Force spy plane was heading towards the border of the former Soviet Union, where a new military base was being built by the Soviets. So the idea was to take a high-flying spy plane and fly over the area, get some good photographs, and then send it back to U.S. photographic analysis so they could undertake a study and see how potentially dangerous this military base could be to the, you know, to the West. And what they did, they actually took off from Turkey, Turkey being our friends, and so they took off from a military base in Turkey and actually had to fly over, or near, I should say, Mount Ararat to reach the location where this particular base was, bordering Turkey and the Soviet Union. And as they closed in on Mount Ararat, right near the top of it, which is pretty much covered in ice all year round, when they reached a height of about 17,000 feet, one of the guys on board the plane, because this was a crew of about five or six, said that he could see what looked like a large wing-like structure protruding out of the thick ice. And so the pilot said, well, let's swing around and just get a couple of pictures. It's not going to affect the overall mission, just to take a few minutes out of our time. So they swung the plane around and got a number of photographs of this strange wing, if that's what it was. As they were turning, one of the guys on the other side of the plane said he could see a similar wing-like structure on another portion of the mountain. So they swung around again and got photographs of both of these odd, curious objects sticking out of the ice, which didn't look like sort of regular rock or anything like that. They looked intelligently constructed. So when they got the pictures, they continued on with the original mission, got back to the base and said, okay, we photographed the Russian military installation, got plenty of aerial photographs for you, but you're not going to believe what else we saw. And that's when they briefed the intelligence team on what they'd seen on Mount Ararat. Now, the photographs have been sort of rumored to exist for years, but some of them have now surfaced into the public domain. I actually reproduced one of them in the book, again, which surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act, and it does show what looks like a strange object sticking out of the ice. Now, at the time, and certainly all the way since then, they actually don't refer to it within government as Noah's Ark. The official term, and it is an official term that's used, is they call it the Ararat Anomaly. And from 1949 onwards, when the Air Force developed those pictures, they actually shared those images with the CIA and later with the Defense Intelligence Agency when that was created. When I started digging into this more and found that there was a CIA file on it, I thought, well, there's no harm in filing a Freedom of Information request. And so I did that, and to my surprise, the CIA sent me about 60 pages from the file. We don't know how extensive the entire file is, but the portions that have been sent that are now available, I mean, they make fascinating reading. For example, they talk about how in 1975, a book was written called Noah's Ark, I Touched It, by a man named Fernand Navarro. And like most authors, you know, when you have a book out, you have to promote it. That's what the publisher wants. He gave a lecture in a shopping mall in Washington, D.C. And the files actually talk about how two CIA agents went along to the lecture and sort of clandestinely sat in the audience and took notes on everything he said. So this sort of begs the question, the Air Force gets these pictures in 49, and clearly 75, you know, we're talking decades later, agents were actually actively researching authors and listening to their lectures and sitting in to the extent of sitting in the audience and making notes on, you know, a biblical mystery, which isn't necessarily the sort of thing you would expect the CIA to have an interest in. And this sort of begs the question, what if it actually wasn't an old boat? And that sort of leads into another part of the story that they looked into as well.
Now, do we know, or did you discover from your research that if anyone went up there to see what was thought to be wings or anything? Did anyone make ascent?
Yeah, well, here's the big problem that I'm sure you know. There have been various expeditions to Mount Ararat looking for Noah's Ark, and some people claim to have found what looks like the imprint or the remains of, you know, an old wrecked boat and so on. The problem is with the area where these photographs were taken, it's literally at the very top of Mount Ararat. If you see most of the expedition photographs, the people who've been on the expeditions have sort of focused on areas further down the mountain. When you see these declassified Air Force pictures, the object, whatever it is practically at the top of the mountain, which is, as I said, literally encased in ice pretty much 24/7, 365 days a year. And so there hasn't really been a concerted effort to study that area, just purely due to the logistics of the environment, and also because the Turkish government isn't keen on having people trampling all around there, and they haven't given permission. Although they have given permission, you know, for lower level expeditions, which in itself is interesting. So, in other words, what we have are aerial photographs, and there are also references in some of the files that spy satellites were supposedly vectored over the area to get high resolution imagery that way as well. Now, those pictures haven't surfaced. So far, we've got about 9 or 10 photographs all showing this object from various angles on the mountain. So there are clearly, as is often the case in these sort of circumstances, we've got part of the story, but we don't have, you know, the full picture as to what might be known behind closed doors, so to speak.
So we don't know if this is ancient Earth technology or alien technology. All we know is that there's something that appears to be man-made that is sticking out from the ice-capped mountain.
Well, that's accurate. That's as far as we sort of know on the outside, so to speak. But we can sort of glean a few things from various data that is contained in the files. For example, the files contain entries that are based on research undertaken by various authors and investigators who had concluded that perhaps Noah's Ark wasn't like a vast old wooden boat. Various researchers, including a guy named George Van Tassel, had theorized that the story of Noah's Ark was based around an ancient truth of like a literal huge alien spacecraft that, when the Earth was in turmoil in some sort of flood-like situation, came down and didn't so much sort of scoop up animals two by two, but was responsible for sort of collecting massive amounts of terrestrial DNA from various animals. And in other words, creating almost like a space ark, you know, where in the event of a worldwide disaster, the Earth could be reseeded because all of the genetic and DNA material had been stored. And the story was that this kind of like an ancient Roswell, this UFO crashed to Earth on Mount Ararat. And because the story was that, you know, it had genetic materials of hundreds of different life forms on the planet, it became mutated into the story of Noah's Ark. Now, whether or not that's true is sort of less important than the fact that all the authors who were talking about that, copies of their records, photocopies from the pages of their books, made their way into the files. So in other words, whether or not Noah's Ark was sort of a crashed alien spacecraft filled with, you know, terrestrial DNA is in some respects less important than the fact that somebody in the government actually thought that was the answer and was actively collecting all the materials. So that kind of gives us an idea of the mindset of why this research was done, the idea of trying to figure out if we were visited in the past and if, you know, ancient technologies from somewhere else were involved in the creation of the Noah's Ark story.
That's amazing. That is just amazing. I want to move on to another chapter. You have it called here, Levitation and the Pharaohs.
Yeah.
And an interesting subject of mine is what you call the acoustic technology. These megaliths, these massive obelisks that the Egyptians made, not only precision involved, some kind of technology involved, and a number of authors have written about it, but there's evidence of some harmonics involved within the stonework that may have been a trigger point for levitation. Can you tell us a little bit about that discovery? Because that's fantastic. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, acoustic levitation is something that in today's world, a number of military and scientific agencies around the world are sort of actively pursuing. And it's something that's there've been sort of mild successes in it, but nothing sort of on the scale that, you know, we might apply to the ancient past. But two friends of mine, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman, dug into this very deeply. And I'll just give you a quote, because acoustic levitation is sort of a very complex thing, but they word it very well. They describe it as two opposing sound frequencies with interfering sound waves that create a resonance zone that allows levitation to occur. Theoretically, to move a levitating object, simply change or alter the two sound waves and tweak accordingly. So it's kind of like, you know, if you sort of push the opposite ends of a magnet together and, you know, you cannot push them together because they're opposing each other. The idea with acoustic levitation is within that gap where you have that concentration, you can actually lift objects. And various military agencies have had success in lifting things like the size of a cell phone through acoustic levitation means. So it is a valid, real technology. The big question is, you know, could it be applied to moving something the size of a car 50 feet in the air, that kind of thing? That's what we haven't achieved yet. But what is fascinating is that when we look back at a lot of these stories of, you know, how massive structures all around the world, whether the pyramids, whether in South America or the UK with Stonehenge, a lot of them have legends attached to them that relate to sound. For example, excuse me, for example, in England, with Stonehenge. There's one particular legend suggests that the stones were moved by what was known as magical music, you know, to the sound of a musical instrument, and the stones would magically rise into the air. Now, you know, I don't think we need to take that literally, the idea that somebody would strum an old style guitar and suddenly the stones would lift. You know, it's not that. But where you have ancient legends, there's usually a grain of truth to them. And I can easily see that, you know, before there was writing and when stories are passed down through families and became legendary and so on, I can easily understand how an ancient and today lost technology based around acoustics to move stones could be over four or five generations be reworked as, you know, like a musical instrument or a tune was used to move mm-hmm. the stones. And there are actually a lot of stories. For example, the walls of the Greek city of Thebes, they were supposedly constructed to the sound of a lyre. A lyre is an early stringed musical instrument. And, mm-hmm. I mean, you can also, for example, look at the fall of the walls of Jericho. They were brought down by trumpets. Well, you could argue that this is acoustic levitation working a different way. For example, today, one application that's been looked at with acoustic technology is using it as a weapon. Now, mm-hmm. anybody who's ever been to a rock concert and stood right in front of the speakers, you'll know how it makes your body judder and shake. Well,
yeah.
if you can direct that, like at a wall, you could bring that down. So in other words, that's another example of sound being used to achieve one particular aim, if you like. And there's another one, for example. I mean, there's so many, but just to give you another, the walls of Troy. The story is that the god Apollo supposedly helped Neptune, one of the other gods, to actually move stones to help build the city of Troy. And the story was that the stones were moved by inspiring tunes. And that's how, I mean, that was in Greece. You know, so you have Greece, you have Stonehenge. You have all sorts of, like South America, the stories as well of some of the ancient structures being constructed by a mysterious race of dwarfs that would whistle at the stones. And then when they whistled, the stones rise into the air. So again, you've got mm-hmm. legends all around the world of sound being used to move stones. And what's interesting, kind of like the whole Noah's Ark thing where somebody was collecting all the writings of various authors that had postulated the Ark was a crashed UFO, in the same way, various government agencies opened files on a number of researchers who were looking into the levitation angle. One of them was a guy named Morris Jessop, who was active in the 50s, and the other one was Bruce Cathy, who wrote a number of books, probably his most famous, called Harmonic 33, which also mm-hmm. postulated the levitation theory. Now, again, it doesn't prove that was the answer. What it does demonstrate, again, is that somebody within government was very interested in this theory that is exactly how the pyramids were built.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the government's interest was to weaponize this technology, or was it more to discover if a technology existed to build the pyramid and other megalithic structures?
Well, I think it was born out of a couple of things. I mean, clearly, you know, it's not the official mandate of the CIA or whoever to investigate ancient biblical or religious mysteries. You know, that's mm-hmm. not their official job. So I think
right.
there has to be another reason for it. So, you know, they may have been, I mean, like with the story of Noah's Ark, it wasn't like they went looking for it. It was because purely by chance photographs surfaced through the Air Force. But yeah, I actually do think the reason for most of this research is to see if it can be weaponized. I mean, if, for example, you could get your hands on a crashed ancient UFO on Mount Ararat, if that's what it is, and you could understand and replicate the technology and the power plants and so on, if it still exists after such a, you know, a great length of time, you could potentially control the planet in a matter of months. You know, if you could duplicate something that did away with the need for fossil fuels and regular aircraft. You know, you could patrol the skies and rule the planet. And it's kind of the same with acoustic levitation. Not only would you have the ability to revolutionize overnight, you know, the whole world of, you know, construction. There'll be no need for cranes or anything, you know, trucks to move things anymore. They could just be sort of levitated along highways or whatever. But also, from the weapon angle, you know, like with the walls of Jericho, there's no doubt that the theoretical side of acoustic levitation shows that it can be used as a weapon to sort of destroy objects if we can figure out how to refine it. You know, it would be the same as like projecting a bullet, but it would be such a concentrated sound wave, just the blast itself could sort of disrupt your organs or whatever, you know.
Exactly. The thing that I was trying to extract from your book was, if you read from Major Philip Corso's book, who wrote a book called After Roswell, he says that the American government actually reversed engineered alien craft in Roswell, and that data is what has been used for a number of technologies like IC chips, wireless technologies, and things like that. And I'm wondering, do you think that there has been some technology captured from ancient, you know, downed craft or anything like that, but that might have been reverse engineered? Because his book is fascinating. Of course, he passed away a number of years ago, but I don't know if you know Corso or not, but that whole reference point of our technology being recovered technology is quite fascinating.
Well, I mean, I actually don't rule that out. I'll tell you for why, because there are a couple of stories, and I point this out in the book, that they are rumors. We don't have documents to support this, but there are people who've come forward talking about sort of elderly family members back in the 50s and 60s who sort of on their deathbed came forward to say that in relation to the Noah's Ark story, that supposedly at some point, possibly in the 50s, we're not entirely sure, that almost like a kind of Delta Force team was actually parachuted onto Mount Ararat late one night to try and check out this one of these large wing-like structures. And the story was that they actually made it there and came across this sort of large, almost like a hollowed out, vast metallic object, sort of semi-encased in the ice. And there are stories about them finding sort of remnants of technology and so on. Now, what's interesting is that the people who've come forward said that the project itself ran under the sort of auspices of an overall project called Moondust. Now, Project Moondust was a legitimate military program. It was set up in the 1950s, and it was essentially designed to sort of study and exploit and duplicate foreign technology. That's to say, let's say the Russians launched a spy satellite and it went out of orbit and it crashed in Montana. Well, the Moondust people would be the quick retrieval team would go out and recover, you know, a Soviet satellite, and then it would be analyzed to see how it compared to our technology. Was it more advanced? Was it less advanced? Were there any new and novel designs that we could exploit and so on? So that was the work of Project Moondust. So it's intriguing that the people are saying that Moondust oversaw the Mount Ararat investigation or quest, if you like, because, again, that suggests that somebody was looking to exploit the technology found on Mount Ararat. And that also ties in with the pyramid and levitation theory. I mentioned that files were opened on one of the, on a number of the levitation theorists, one being Morris Jessop, as I said. He was actually, in 1957, flown out to Washington, D.C., where he was interviewed quite extensively about his research by a U.S. Navy Special Weapons Research Division. So, again, there seems to be an indication there that somebody was actively trying to, you know, utilize or at least first understand the technology, then try and replicate it, and then see what could be done with it.
Okay. You hint on possible acoustic use of ancient pyramids, both in the Maya, Central America, and South America. Have you come up with anything more than what we know about, which is that the Maya had a uncanny ability to build structures with acoustic properties? As an example, the Chichen Itza, the El Castillo pyramid, which I've been to many times, has strange properties that actually, if you stand at the very top, you can whisper and people at the bottom can hear you. And apparently there's another recent discovery that if you clap your hands in a certain way when you're standing on the pyramid, it sounds like a bird of an ancient bird or something like that. I'm wondering, if you've discovered anything else in any of the pyramids that we know about that are from the ancient world that have acoustic properties?
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would say is that, a lot of research has also been done into this area at Stonehenge as well, sort of the idea of resonating stones. And one of the interesting ideas is sort of the resonating could potentially have, not a bad effect, but an alternative effect, if you like, on the human mind, to where it would allow you almost to enter like a trance-like state. You know, I mean, a lot of, for example, people who, you know, have anxiety, there are like recordings, sound recordings that allow the person to go into a more relaxed state and that sort of slow the heartbeat down. And it's not, you know, just through listening to relaxing music, it's actually sort of resonating repetitive noise. And by noise, I don't mean sort of blasting out. I mean just something at like a comfortable level. And it's been theorized that this may have been utilized at Stonehenge. Sort of the stones would resonate and give off this sort of echoey, almost like a hypnotic beat that would, the theory was, it would allow us to sort of commune with the gods in almost like a shamanic fashion. You know, your mind would enter an altered state and it would open doorways to other realms. Now, whether or not that was achievable or not, of course, is debatable. But what I do think is sort of fascinating is that not only do we have these legends about sound being made to move the stones, but also it's clear that the ancients, from the acoustic properties of some of the ancient structures in Mexico and South America, and particularly in Egypt as well, ancient man clearly had some sort of affinity with acoustics, and a lot of these places and chambers were built to achieve a maximum acoustic effect. And so, you know, there's clearly an aspect here that of the phenomenon of these ancient structures that we're not really seeing the full picture of. You know, most people take the black and white view that, oh yeah, they just built these huge structures as, you know, as a place to pray in, or et cetera, et cetera. No, there's something about these that where acoustics play a major role. And I think what's happened is that we today have lost the technology, a very alternative technology, that we don't really understand how it works, and we don't understand how the ancients were able to achieve it when we're not able to today. But I think we're looking at like a forgotten technology and a lost technology. I don't think somebody's sitting on the secrets. I think it genuinely has been lost, and we're trying to figure out what it actually was.
Yes. Mayan elder, actually he is a mentor of mine, his name is Humbats Mint, has said that NASA, over the last decade, has made many trips to a number of ruins in Central America. And he's not quite sure what they were doing because they wouldn't tell him. But apparently they have been testing a number of the buildings down there to discover certain emissions. And we know from the work of John Burke that a lot of these buildings were built on magnetic faults, according to him, the structures, there's a technology that's lost to us that actually these buildings were able to magnify the electromagnetic emissions from these buildings. So it's a question if they've actually been able to find anything or duplicate that. And of course, we have to always think about the Americans wanting to weaponize everything. If they built some electromagnetic gun or something that we're gonna read about. But anyhow, I want to talk to you about a chapter also that kind of focuses on the Indiana Jones TV series that Steven Spielberg had great interest in, and that's Hitler and the Nazis' search for ancient artifacts. Now, you have a number of focal points in the book. One is the Spear of Destiny, and then the Ark of the Covenant. Did they actually find anything related to that? Did the Nazis actually discover anything that we know about in that area?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the sheer extent to which the whole sort of Nazi regime, if you like, was dominated and inspired by ancient mysteries and sort of the races that came before us, for example. I mean, the whole angle of the Nazis supposedly being the master race, I mean, that all sort of goes right back to ancient times, you know, where the Nazis, part of their teachings was that their lineage could be traced back to ancient superhumans. That's essentially what they believed in. But the Nazis were actually interested in a lot of ancient mysteries, and a lot of this work actually fell under the jurisdiction of a group called the Anerb, and this was a group established specifically through the Nazi Party when Hitler came to power to travel the world in sort of hot pursuit of mystical relics and ancient artifacts. One of the ones that they were after was the Holy Grail, with the sort of the plate or the cup that was supposedly used by Jesus at the Last Supper. And there were beliefs that, you know, whoever possess this, that it supposedly itself possessed sort of mystical powers that could be used. And so that was one of the reasons, again, that for the main reason for the Nazi interest. It wasn't so much they were interested in just collecting archaeological souvenirs, although that was part of it. It was the potential destructive power of these technologies. Now, in, for example, in the Raiders of the Lost Ark film, which is obviously fictionalized, the race is on the part of the Nazis to try and find the Ark of the Covenant. Now, of course, the Ark of the Covenant is a very strange story about this sort of chest that could, you know, if you get too close to it, people would die, and had all sorts of strange powers, and, you know, could reportedly was involved in the bringing down of the walls of Jericho and the parting of the Red Sea. And some people have likened it to almost like some of these deaths potentially could have been through electrocution, as if it was giving off massive amounts of static electricity or something like that. And we know now that the CIA actually opened a file on the Ark of the Covenant. So that this doesn't directly relate to the Nazis, but we know there was a CIA file on the Ark of the Covenant, which was actually heavily influenced by the research of Edgar Cayce into the Ark of the Covenant. But another area that the Nazis were reportedly looking into was Tiwanaku in Bolivia, a pre-Incan site, which actually, interestingly enough, was a major area of interest for Morris Jessop, who did a lot of research into ancient levitation. And the Anunnab actually traveled out to Tiwanaku to figure out, you know, what was going on there, were the technologies they could exploit. This was actually in 1939, you know, just as war was about to erupt. And so this was a very ambitious project, and it was only really scaled down when the Germans started to lose the war, and then, you know, they had to sort of fight on the home front, so to speak. But up until that point, they had a concerted network traveling the world just looking to plunder and get hold of ancient artifacts and see what could be done with them. I mean, for example, people like Rudolf Hess and Himmler, they were heavily influenced by the world of the occult and using rituals to sort of try and provoke and invoke ancient gods and things like that.
So they wanted to enhance their armies and use these occult technologies in some way. But we don't know you know, if the Ark of the Covenant ever existed, no one's ever found it. And, of course, there's been a number of movies about the Spear of Destiny. So it could have been all a wasted effort. Do we actually know if the Nazis actually sent teams out to do these discoveries, this research? Or is it all speculation?
Oh, yeah, we know they went out. I mean, they spent extensive time. You can see photographs online now of some of their expeditions, for example, to Bolivia, where they spent a great deal of time looking into early Bolivian legends of sort of magical devices and technology from the gods and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason was they were looking to sort of vindicate their crazy beliefs that they were the master race. In other words, they were looking for evidence of this ancient race that they perceived were responsible for their lineage, you know, the blonde hair, blue eyes angle that the Nazis wanted to approach. They were looking for evidence that would support that. But they were also, as I said, looking for many of these mystical artifacts. The problem is, you're quite right, we don't know if the Ark of the Covenant really existed or what it was. And actually, Hitler realized that, and so that's why he actually sent these teams out, because it wasn't just a case of go and get the technology. Well, first we've got to figure out if it actually does exist or did exist. So, you know, they were sort of mindful of that fact that they were dealing with legends, that it was legends that they were trying to prove. But fortunately, you know, they lost the war. You know, that's the main thing that came out of it. They didn't succeed in their goals, thankfully.
There's always been a question that if the war had extended, they were going to introduce the jet and even more powerful rockets than they shot out. And so there's always been a question about where their technology came from. But, of course, it's a very bright people, so maybe that's just...
The thing. It's almost amazing that they didn't win the war because, you know, they created the first jet engine, the first rocket, like the V-1 and the V-2. And that's why at the end of the Second World War, you know, there was this Operation Paperclip that brought the Nazi scientists over to the U.S. They worked at White Sands to help, you know, in the post-war period. It was like, you're either going to go to jail or you're going to help us, you know. And and that's what happened. And, of course, Wernher von Braun, who, you know, built the V-1 and V-2 rockets that bombed Europe in the Second World War, von Braun actually became director of NASA. You know, so he was.
Yes.
He sort of
people
really
upset about that
command.
Too. Yeah, a lot of people are upset about him becoming the head of NASA.
Well, I mean, it's one of these things where, of course, at the end of the Second World War, the Russians were already sort of, you know, clearly the next big threat. And sometimes, you know, when you're dealing with that sort of situation, a potential threat of nuclear war from the Russians, they had to do what they had to do to get scientists on board to ensure that, you know, the Western world wasn't vaporized. And, you know, sometimes that involves doing deals that you might not want to do, but for the long-term good, you know, it has to be done sometimes.
And both countries were interested in acquiring technology because it was obvious to us that the Nazis had developed some rocket technology that was just out of this world. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We have just a few more minutes. I want to touch on a couple of other things. You have a chapter here called Stonehenge and Secret Files, where you discuss the British Ministry's interest in stones. And tell us a little bit about that, because I find that interesting. There's a lot to talk about, but you have a declassified 6-page file titled Unexplained Events, where Avebury stones are discussed and things like that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the British Ministry of Defence has had, in varying degrees since the 40s, an interest in the UFO phenomenon, like a lot of countries, and they've opened files and done investigations and studies to try and figure out what's going on. But digging through some of the archives, I found a number of records showing that at various times, and chiefly in the 50s through the 60s, the Ministry of Defence had been fascinated by the fact that there'd been sightings of not so much sort of big gleaming flying saucers, but strange balls of light around stone circles, not just Stonehenge, but as you pointed out, the Avebury Circle, which is a huge circle of stones, actually bigger than Stonehenge in terms of the circumference, but the stones are much smaller, the sort of the height of a man upwards, you know, to about 10 feet or so. And they found that there are a number of cases where people who've been walking around the stones and had seen these strange balls of light had had their sort of minds affected, where they'd had sort of visionary experiences, or they felt kind of hypnotized or under some sort of control. And so, again, the Ministry of Defence was looking to try and figure out what these strange balls of light were and why they were being seen in and around the vicinity of Avebury and Stonehenge. And so this little project was established to investigate this phenomenon, which they called plasmas. And the idea was, if we could replicate or understand these plasmas and we could utilize them on the battlefield, we could sort of scramble the brains of the enemy. That was the idea. In other words, yeah. They were fascinated as to why these plasma phenomena were turning up around stone circles. That was of an interest to them. But the greater interest was, well, all these people are saying, as soon as they got within 10 or 15 feet of these plasmas, they felt weirded out. They felt hypnotized, as if something was, you know, controlling them. And that then became the thrust of the research. And over the years, right through the 1990s, they were still looking into this plasma angle to see if it could be used as like a mind-altering weapon. So, again, like with the US research, they weren't specifically looking from an archaeological perspective to solve all the mysteries of the past. It was just, you know, what can we do with the past to help us defeat the Russians or the Chinese or whoever?
Right. But did you, in your research, discover any evidence of U.S. or British military acquiring science, technology, or anything from ancient documents or manuals or anything? I ask this because a few years ago, there was a report that 1,000 Mayan codices were found in a basement in a Los Angeles vault. And the reports were out there, and the Mayan elders who I've spoken to said that before the Spanish came, there were codices on science, on astronomy, on technology that they had inherited. And if anyone had discovered or actually had taken those codices, I mean, the sky's the limit as to what may have been revealed. So my question to you would be, what do you think, or what do you speculate on government agencies uncovering documents?
Well, I think, you know, there actually is fragmentary evidence of this. I mean, the chapter that I start the book with deals with the Dead Sea Scrolls and how in 1947, the year in which the CIA was created, that they were very interested in the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls and actually acquired some scrolls through the CIA office in Damascus that related to stories that haven't surfaced in the Dead Sea Scrolls that are on public display today. And reportedly, the documents in question, this ancient sort of manuscript that the CIA got its hands on, talked about things like prophecies and so prophesizing the future and altered states and out-of-body experiences. That's how they interpreted what these ancient manuscripts were talking about. And this story actually came excuse me, from a man named Miles Copeland. Miles Copeland was actually the CIA station director in Damascus in 1947, and he said he saw this one particular scroll that was brought in, and he examined it, photographed it. All the photographs and the scroll were sent to the CIA in Washington, D.C., excuse me, in Langley, Virginia, for analysis, and he never saw or heard of it again. But rumors came back that somebody who'd analyzed and translated it became very concerned but also interested by the notion that there were potential revelations in there that dealt with, as I said, future forecasting and sort of psychically leaving the body. And this may have, I speculate, this may have sort of prompted a lot of the early research that government agencies did into things like psychic phenomena and ESP, again, as a tool to use against the Russians. And one sort of little weird aside, Miles Copeland, who ran the office, he was actually the father of Stuart Copeland, the drummer with the Police, which is has nothing to do with the story. It's just a weird story.
Well, that is, I guess that's an interesting link there. Okay, so I find it amazing that you are able to get so much, you're continually, sounds like you're able to get these declassified documents.
Well, I mean, it's one of these situations where a lot of people give the government a bad rap, but I have to be honest, I've always found them to be, agencies all around the world, to be very good at releasing files if they can. You know, I mean, obviously there are a lot of files that don't get released for national security reasons, and it's clear from the references, for example, in the CIA file on Noah's Ark, it's clear from reading it that there are references to other files that haven't surfaced yet. But where they can release files, you know, they will, and they you know, they can offer significant insight. The thing is, it's kind of like a detective story where a lot of people just don't take the time to sort of, you know, request files and see if they can be released. And then if they if that particular file mentions something, then you go digging for that file and so on. So a lot, it's sort of a lot of hard detective work, and I think that's why people just don't realize what's potentially available, because most people get a little bit daunted by the fact that you've got to go through this whole process and, you know, sitting for hours in dusty old archives or whatever.
Yeah. But here's a question for you. Do you think the government would be positioned in such a way that if someone did access, an independent researcher accessed technology like anti-gravity or some system where energy was produced without the need for fossil fuels, that they would seek that individual out and even, you know, there'd be death threats or something like that? Do you think that our government or the British, what do you think about that?
I've never actually seen that happen. I mean, what I do think is probably something like with Maurice Jessop, where they might actually consult the person and hire them to come on board. I mean, Maurice Jessop, this guy in the 50s, who was actually, he wrote all about sort of levitation theories for in relation to the South American and Egyptian structures. And I said the Navy read his book, flew him out, and it wasn't like a good cop, bad cop situation. It was just like a regular sit down, hey, would you mind sharing your concepts and ideas? And that's what he did. So I actually think it's sort of less some sort of sinister X-Files thing where somebody, you know, might not come out the other end alive. Although it has to be said, Maurice Jessop was found dead a couple of years later in a very suspicious suicide. But I do think probably the most ideal way would be to bring the person on board to use their expertise. You know, if they really have uncovered something profound, wiping them out isn't necessarily going to help the position of the people doing the research. It might be better just to offer them a significant sum of money, sign this non-disclosure thing, and you'll come and work for us for the next 5 years or whatever.
So you don't feel, or you haven't detected any of these black project groups that are reportedly taking money from the government and reverse engineering or building things and flying them around?
I've heard a lot of stories like that. But I think sometimes if it's somebody who's got a particularly strong alternative scientific mind who thinks out of the box and, you know, focuses on alternative concepts, they're the sort of people they like to work with, because when you're dealing with alternative weird technologies, you want people who do think outside the box. Sometimes it actually works in their favor to employ sort of maverick type scientists rather than, you know, the regular sort of glasses and pipe types, you know what I mean? And so for that reason, I think that people probably often do get brought into these programs and nobody ever knows about it, you know, and that would make sense, I think. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about sort of black programs and sort of shadow governments that that are sort of the ones who are really hiding the deep and dark facts about what's going on, rather than the regular government knowing. You know, I think that's a strong possibility, that it's not so much the government that's hiding all this, or possibly any of it. It may just be like some sort of rogue shadow agency that's, you know, gone on its own tangent, so to speak.
Well, I have to mention that in your book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon, that you don't get into too much conspiracy theory, which I do appreciate, because you can go on and on and on about conspiracy this, and this person was killed, and it gets out of hand. I mean, so I do appreciate that, that aspect.
Well, it is. I'm interested in conspiracy theories, but you're right. What I've tried to do with the book is the subject matters are fantastic enough, you know, crashed UFOs on Mount Ararat and levitating 30-ton stones or whatever. So what I've tried to do is go demonstrate to the reader that, you know, these documents, like on Noah's Ark, most people have probably never seen them, and they're official documents. You know, they're not leaked, not questionable, or anything like that. They've legally surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. And so when you're talking about incredible concepts, I think it's always important to have credible rather than incredible data to back it up. So.
Exactly. So my guest today has been Nick Redfern. The book is The Pyramids and the Pentagon. Nick, are you going to be – why don't you tell us where you're going to be so we can hear you, if you're going to be speaking in any conferences this summer or upcoming in the fall. Why don't you tell us where you're going to be, if you are going to be anywhere.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm actually speaking about the pyramids at the Pentagon, and the Pentagon, I should say, at a conference out in Joshua Tree, California, on the weekend of August the 8th to the 10th. And it's called the Contact in the Desert Conference. So if you type that into a search engine, Contact in the Desert Conference, plus Joshua Tree, you'll see all the information on the conference. As I said, that's the weekend of August the 8th through the 10th. And I'll also be doing a workshop on my book, The Real Men in Black. And I'll also be speaking, one of my other big interests is cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. And I'll be speaking at the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, on the weekend of September the 19th to the 21st. And one other event I'll be speaking at, which is called the Paradigm Symposium, which is in Minneapolis. That's on the weekend of October the 3rd to the 5th. And all those events are all contactable and findable online.
Okay, and I'm going to go ahead and post your Blogspot link, which is Nick Redfern 14.com. Blogspot.com. I will post that for everyone to get that. And the book is available on Amazon, so it's quite easily available. And one last question before I let you go. You're such a prolific writer. What do you have coming up for us? What's in the mind of Nick Redfern for the future?
Well, I actually have a book on a totally different subject coming out in September. It's called The Zombie Book, and it's all like an A to Z of everything to do with zombies in folklore, in TV, everything from like The Walking Dead to George Romero movies, novels, folklore, but right back to sort of Egyptian traditions of raising the dead, and then everything through like voodoo and New Orleans and viruses, and you know, it's like an A to Z of everything to do with The Walking Dead and zombies and, you know, that kind of thing, end of the world. So I think there's like 400 entries in the book, all in like an A to Z fashion. So
what is it about zombies that has everyone
people just fascinated by it. I mean, it's like, you know, a couple of years ago it was Twilight and all those vampire things, you know, and now it's zombies. I mean, it'll be something else probably in another 5 years, but who knows?
Who knows? Nick, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. For those of you listening, do look on the Facebook page for more information on Nick and his book. The book is called The Pyramids and the Pentagon, The Government's Top Secret Pursuit of Mystical Relics, Ancient Astronauts, and Lost Civilizations. Do check in with us next week. We are constantly updating the program And there is a lot to listen to. And also, there's more information on the megaliths of Baalbek and also around the world. And do check in with Earth Ancients on Facebook. And I am going to be releasing a website soon, and there will be more information there. So have a great day. We'll see you.